All right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I just feel like having those drums just roll all day long. All right, that's what I need. That's what's got it's got me up and jumping. Okay, that's right. We have a packed show for you today. All right, and I'm not kidding in the least. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with actor Jesus Castanos-Chima, and we're going to be talking about the play La Razón Blindada. It's a really important play, and we'll be talking more about that as we get along. Before that, we'll be talking to Joey Johnson and one of the defendants, one of the two defendants who were facing major charges, major felony charges, in Cleveland, in the Cleveland courts, as a result of standing up against, being part of the whole movement against the Trump regime at the Cleveland RNC, Republican National Convention. And they just scored a major victory, all right? And we'll be talking with you about that very soon. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show somebody I'm always, always happy to hear from. Her name is Sansara Taylor, and she's a writer for RevCom.us, Revolution Newspaper, and she's one of the co-initiators of RefuseFascism.org. And she's currently in Berkeley, where the fascist Ben Shapiro just spoke amid huge protests and a speak out against white supremacy, misogyny, and fascism. And Sansara is going to talk with us about what the hell is going on in Berkeley right now and in the entire country. Sansara, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. It's great to be back with you.
Yeah, it's really good to, I know every time I have you on the show, it's like always these very exciting things. Here you had Shapiro speaking at Berkeley last night, and you have actually coming up very soon Milo Yiannopoulos and others, Bannon, Ann Coulter, Breitbart Media. They're all scheduled to come into Berkeley in late September and to speak there.
Yeah.
Very soon. It's going to be a hellified time. It's going to be a time when people really need to stand up and show where they're at. And I wanted to talk with you about this because, as I was saying earlier, Shapiro spoke last night under heavy police protection and unprecedented measures taken to protect his ability, supposedly his ability to speak without being driven off the stage in the campus. And in the middle of that, you were out there talking with people and organizing people. There was a speak out against white supremacy, misogyny, and fascism. So I wanted to talk to you about what the hell was going on. Give us a snapshot at the scene if there needs to be any more filling in about what happened at Berkeley last night.
Well, I think first we have to say that fascists are targeting Berkeley as part of and in the service of a Trump-Pence fascist regime. I'll talk a little bit about this, but there's an unprecedented who's who of misogynists, woman haters, of crank conspiracy theorists, of high-level white supremacists who worked in the regime, Steve Bannon, Ann Coulter, somebody who says that liberals should be put in Guantanamo, that black youth should be taken into the street and publicly whipped. You have Mike Cernovich, who's like a complete troll, crank, woman hater, conspiracy theorist, completely illegitimate. Milo Yiannopoulos, a fascist provocateur. You have a whole string of them, and they're targeting Berkeley. They're demanding their, quote, right to speak at Berkeley. Ben Shapiro was part of this last night. And I think we have to understand this is because of what Berkeley represents. In the eyes of the world, what made Berkeley, Berkeley, the movements of the 60s, the movements against white supremacy, the movements against unjust imperialist war, this is targeting Berkeley because part of consolidating fascism in this country requires intimidating and chilling out and crushing the spirit of resistance and opposition and humanity that exists beyond and around this country, but is concentrated and symbolized in Berkeley in a very real way. And it's a dual assault because they're also assaulting the American university. They're targeting Cal, but as part of an assault on the universities across the country, because universities are a place. No, they're not, as Ben Shapiro likes to say, a place dominated by leftist thuggery. They're not that. They're ruling class institutions that churn out people who go into policy and go into business and go and keep the machinery of capitalism, imperialism running. But they are places that have more initiative for critical thinking than other parts of society. People do work with ideas, and young people are learning about the world and going through changes. And so there's a reason why students and the campuses have always been on the front edge of resistance and protest against injustice. So the fascists targeting Berkeley are doing this as part of an assault to chill out a strategic vulnerability for fascism, what Berkeley represents and what the campuses represent. And they're fighting to get a foothold and normalize fascism as part of crushing opposition in this country and consolidating what is a fascist regime. And I think I'll talk about the speak out we did last night. 1,500 students or more came out and raised their voices in opposition in different ways to Ben Shapiro, and we could talk about who he is. But I think it's really important that people understand, most of all, most of all that all this sits within and is playing a role in an incredibly dangerous moment in human history, when there is a openly fascist, openly white supremacist, openly xenophobic and ethnically cleansing oriented, openly misogynist, trying to slam women back with the Christian fascist fundamentalists way up in this White House, and the crude misogyny of Donald Trump in a slightly different form. But all of this and the nuclear threats against the world, all of this is at a moment that is unparalleled in its danger. It's being consolidated, it's being normalized, and they're targeting Berkeley as a key part of that. And so that's why we put so much energy into mobilizing people to stand up and recognize this danger and say no, not just because of the harm it'll do to students on campus, although that's real, but fundamentally because of the harm this is doing to humanity.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that the chancellor at Berkeley said, and she said a couple things that really kind of, I think, kind of we have to speak to or actually, you know, point out, is that she argued that, well, okay, but the university is actually obliged to go all out to protect Shapiro's right to speak. And she argued around that and basically saying that it has a duty to protect the right of students to protest as well. And she tried to say that those two things aren't sort of canceling each other out, but that there's actually, she was putting a lot of import and arguing that she was right in saying that, what about the right of Shapiro to speak?
Well, first of all, I do, listeners who may not be familiar with Ben Shapiro, and he likes to portray himself as sort of a, he's been critical of Trump in some aspects, and he likes to say that we're off base. Actually, he used the Refuse Fascism flyer as the opening of his speech last night and said, oh, how can I be in the service of the Trump-Pence fascist regime? I didn't vote for Trump. But Ben Shapiro is a promoter of white supremacy. He says that poverty among black people is not caused by racism, it's caused by black culture. He mocked Trayvon Martin on what would have been his 21st birthday. He openly said, and I quote, Arabs like to bomb crap and live in open sewage. This is his response to the prison state that Israel has turned Gaza into. It's to blame people for the horrendous genocidal oppression that's been inflicted on them and use that to demean a whole people. And this is, we could go on and on. He thinks, he said last night on stage that abortion doctors should be put on trial, that women should be forced to have children against their will. So what he's doing is he's promoting ideas and policies and rationalizations for the very things that are being imposed through the power of the state with the Trump-Pence regime. His criticism of Trump was from the right. He thought Trump wasn't consistent enough. So this is in the service of the Trump-Pence fascist regime. And this is where Chancellor Crist claimed that she has an obligation, that this is about free speech. This is not about free speech. Fascism has a platform, the most powerful and biggest platform in the world, the White House. And it is using that platform not just to spew these toxic ideas, but to enforce it with the ICE raids, with the Muslim ban that is largely in effect, with the tearing up of families, with the unleashing and sanctioning of white supremacy inside law enforcement, with Donald Trump standing in front of the law enforcement in Long Island when he spoke, and he said, don't be too nice, rough them up when you arrest people, encouraging and calling for police brutality. But also when he stood and said he saw fine people in Charlottesville carrying torches and chanting blood and soil Nazi slogans and white supremacy and all of this. This is being sanctioned. This has a platform. This is being imposed on people. What is being suppressed is the ability of people to stand up against that. This was, for people who don't know, Berkeley last night was turned into a police state. They did an unprecedented, they locked down the whole center of the campus, including the home of the free speech movement, Sproul Plaza. They locked it down. They brought in police, concrete barricades, huge barricades, and created a quote-unquote perimeter. There was hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of cops in riot gear. There was, after a 20-year ban on the police's ability to use pepper spray, city council in Berkeley gave police the ability to use pepper spray against protesters. There was so much repression, so many lies told about the protests, so much legitimization of fascism last night, and it's very dangerous. And what Refuse Fascism did is said, this cannot go down. We were out there. We said, no, the problem is not campus thuggery. That was the name of Shapiro's speech. The problem is fascist intellectual thuggery in the service of the Trump-Pence fascist regime. And we organized and we went out among the students and we exposed who Shapiro really is and how this is connected to the regime and to the whole string of very high-level, very dangerous fascists who are coming in just a week and a half to assault Berkeley, to pummel this place, to normalize fascism and to chill out and intimidate everybody against it. And we said we have to stand up, and we brought people together. We did a speak out. It was very positive. A lot of students spoke. There was a student sit-in in one of the buildings that was supposed to be closed for Ben Shapiro's appearance, emptied by the police, and they refused to leave. It was very righteous what they did. There were other forms of opposition, but we led people to stand up. But most of all, we were opposed to what's happening last night in Berkeley. We're opposed to what's happening in a week and a half in Berkeley. And fighting this has huge stakes. But most of all, we're organizing people that we have to fight each outrage. But if you just chase each outrage, even the ones as huge as what's happening in Berkeley, fascism can absorb individual acts of resistance and continue to pummel ahead. And that's what we've seen. That's what we've seen since January when Trump Pence were inaugurated, is there's been incredible resistance, unprecedented resistance. And yet the regime has marched forward. The nightmare is being imposed. The normalization is going on. And we have to get organized to drive them out. So November 4th, refusefascism.org is organizing and calling on everybody from many different perspectives. We don't agree on many things within Refuse Fascism and out in the streets last night, and that's fine. But we all have to come together and recognize the catastrophic danger, the nightmare that's being imposed, and that we have to move together. Outside of normal political channels, going into the streets November 4th, there are massive protests around the country, and people need to be part of planning this and organizing for this, but they're not just for one day. The idea is we go day after day, night after night, that we grow from many thousands in major cities across the country to tens of thousands to millions. And we do something similar to what they did in South Korea last year, where people went out in the streets night after night after night, and they were told that there was nothing the government could do. They wanted to get rid of their president. And they said, well, we can't do anything. And they said, we don't care. She's illegitimate. We're going to keep standing here. And they did that. And it took weeks, it took months, but they kept coming, millions and millions. And they created such a crisis that they were able to force that president out. Now, the stakes here are so much bigger. So much bigger. They're pouring gasoline on global warming. They're stripping and purging the scientists so we won't even know how bad things are getting. They're criminalizing women's access to abortion. They're banning trans people. They're doing this assault on the American university. They're criminalizing protests. We don't have forever. The lesson of history is you have to stop fascism before it's too late. And so this is November 4th. It begins. Everybody has to get involved in this. So we're engaged in what we call the battle for Berkeley because it has disproportionate stakes, but it sits within a larger situation, which everybody has a responsibility to, which is the fight to drive out the Trump-Pence regime, to say this nightmare must end, the Trump-Pence regime must go. And so this is something, November 4th, that all this has to build towards. And then that has to be the beginning of a whole different level of struggle that everybody has to be involved in.
Before I go into my next question, I want to remind listeners that this is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Sansara Taylor, writer for RevCom.us, Revolution Newspaper, and we're talking about the Battle of Berkeley. I have one more question I want to ask you about the thing last night that actually I think is important in terms of people trying to understand some of this. And then I have another question about Antifa that I'd like to get into, too, because there's different ways that people, that the rulers have been.
I have an announcement I want to reinforce that I made last night, so I hope
okay.
we get to that.
We definitely will. We have about 10 more minutes, so we'll be fine.
Okay, great.
All right. So I wanted to ask you this, though, because one of the things that the university is arguing is that this is all about, well, they can argue the free marketplace of ideas, but they go beyond that. They go beyond that sort of canard and they get into this thing of you know, that there's actually truth. There's a battle for the truth. And a lot of the way that falls out is the contestation of different ideas, you know, and that the university has made the argument that it is all about the free expression of ideas in the society. And they argue in a sense that it's disconnected from any immediate ties to the effect, or it's disconnected from what the actual effects are. But they say that this is the way that they're guaranteeing that there will be freedom of speech is actually guaranteeing that the good will win out in a certain sense, and that this it's only through this contestation of ideas. If you don't have that, then you have fascism. What would you say to that?
Well, so Chancellor Crist, I actually myself in a writing group from RevCom.us, did a response to Chancellor Crist's rationalizations about bringing fascists to Berkeley in the name of free speech. And there's a number of things that we said about that, including the fact that these fascists have a platform. No one's saying that to stand up and protest and even shut them down is right and righteous and is not a violation of their free speech. It's an exercise of people's speech, assembly, and responsibility, frankly. But we also went into, and this has got a lot of people confused, so it's important to talk about. She drew from John Stuart Mill, and two main points that he made that she drew from. She said, one, the truth is of such a character that it will always ultimately prevail, so you should answer hate speech or toxic speech or bad speech with more speech. But the problem with this is that the truth doesn't prevail on its own. I mean, history is riddled with cemeteries and killing fields of people whose lives were taken and destroyed by the fact that truth doesn't just win out on its own. I mean, what was the Holocaust? What about slavery? What about the lie that black people are three-fifths human? How many lives were destroyed and decimated? How much suffering that continues down to the day is behind those lies? And no, the truth does not prevail on its own. That takes struggle. When there are class forces and ruling interests behind those lies, it is a question of struggle. Truth does not prevail on its own. So it's a lie, what she was saying. Two, she says, you know, as soon as you start to suppress anybody's speech, all speech becomes vulnerable to suppression. And this is a commonly held view, promoted all the time, but it's simply not true. If you go back and look at any of the ability for the Iraqi people and their interests and their lives and their ability to speak, was that advanced by protecting the ability of George Bush to spread his lies about WMDs in Iraq as a justification for invasion? Obviously not. Would it have harmed the interests of enslaved Africans in this country to suppress the speech and the actions of slave owners? Obviously not. Would it have ensured a better outcome for Jewish people in Nazi Germany to make sure we better protect the rights of Nazis to speak? Obviously not. This is just a myth, and it's a myth in the service of rationalizing her own collaboration with fascists. And so these are commonly held views that you have to protect the speech that you find most reprehensible or else your own speech will be subject to suppression. No. Now, there is a very important point from John Stuart Mill. And this is something that Bob Avakian has written about and wrestled with and really fought for in the context of the new synthesis of communism that he's brought forward, which is that people need to hear views put forward by their most ardent advocates, that you need a huge clash of ideas and contestation. But, and this is very important, that principle, as important as it is not an absolute and cannot be elevated above or treated as something absent the real world conditions and the questions of power relations that enter into that. And the ideas that most need protection are those ideas which are unpopular, which are poorly understood, which challenge existing authority, including ruling authority, which challenge the existing modes and relations of production, and ideas especially that the ruling authorities, the ruling classes, are actively suppressing and distorting. Those are the ideas that most need protection. The ideas of Shapiro, the ideas of Milo Yiannopoulos, the ideas of Trump, these don't need special protection. They have the biggest bully pulpit in the world. So you can't act like suppressing, or not even suppressing, driving out and shutting down through disruptive protests somebody who's representing and being a shill for a fascist regime is somehow suppressing speech in the same way that the police out on the street with riot gear and pepper spray, terrorizing protesters who are raising their voices against that power, that's the suppression. So I think these things they have to be worked through in the real world. And I would commend to everybody, because these are important issues, to go to revcom.us, where we really take this apart in an open letter response to Chancellor Crist. And in the work of Bob Avakian, including a number of talks, including the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic of North America, which he authored and which deals with this question of freedom of expression. And most of all, including in a very important speech that he will be giving at UC Berkeley about freedom of expression and the Communist Revolution next year. So maybe we could talk about that too.
Yeah, well, let's jump into that because and I'll have to have you back to talk about the attack on Antifa because I think it's really important that people get straight on that, actually get their thinking straight on that, on what's happening with that. But I want to talk about this announcement you just made because that's actually, in a lot of ways, that's actually can be a game changer in a lot of ways for this, for the direction of the movement overall.
Yeah, so last night amidst these protests and under the guise of what UC Berkeley is calling their free speech year, I made the announcement out on the street during the protest that Bob Avakian, the most radical revolutionary alive, chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, author of the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic in North America, former student of UC Berkeley, and an active participant in the original, the actual free speech movement, will be speaking at UC Berkeley in April of 2018. And he'll be speaking on the question of freedom of expression and the communist revolution. And as part of this, he'll be exposing and refuting the lies and distortion that, that Chancellor Crist has been spreading about the free speech movement. She's been saying that it was a movement of students from the right and students from the left coming together to be able to take up off-campus issues. This is a lie. Avakian was in the middle of this movement. He writes about it in his memoir. It was a movement of students standing up against white supremacy and fighting for the ability and the responsibility of students to take up that battle. So while Chancellor Crist and the university administration have done tremendous harm already in misrepresenting and misappropriating the free speech movement as an excuse to accommodate and facilitate fascist provocateurs like Ben Shapiro, Milo Yiannopoulos, and now Bannon, Coulter, a whole string of others, while they've done this, it would not only be the height of hypocrisy, it would do still further damage to the actual exercise of freedom of expression if they were to be involved in any way in suppressing or placing obstacles in the way of Bob Avakian speaking on campus about an emancipating communist revolution and freedom of expression in relation to that. This speech that Bob Avakian will give is going to refute these lies that have been spread, but it's also going to be talking about what kind of world is possible. What kind of world has given rise to this situation where fascists are on the march, in power, and assaulting Berkeley and every other corner of society? And how do we understand freedom of expression under this system and also in the revolution? It's counterintuitive to a lot of people the way they've been bombarded with lies about communism. But freedom of expression is an integral part of the new synthesis of communism that Bob Avakian has brought forward, which is actually a revolution to emancipate all of humanity. It's reflected in the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic. And I do want to repeat, I know we're going to run out of time, but I've said it a few times, but it's really important and it's new to a lot of people. Fascism has a platform, the biggest and most powerful platform in the world. It has the platform of the White House. And the principle articulated by John Stuart Mill concerning the importance of the contestation of ideas, this is a principle whose basic importance Bob Avakian himself has emphasized. This principle is crucial in particular for the dissemination and the critical evaluation of poorly known ideas, unpopular ideas, and especially if these are ideas that the dominant forces and relations of society, including the state, do not favor or actively work to discredit, contain, or suppress. And this is why it would be the height of hypocrisy for Chancellor Crist, for the university to do anything to interfere with this speech from Bob Avakian going forward, which is going to help both intervene in this battle of Berkeley and help make Berkeley what it was and what it needs to be even more now, but also open up to a lot of people what kind of world is possible and introduce people to a leader who has given, since the free speech movement, decades and decades, he's been on the front lines, he's been giving all of his critical abilities, all of his scientific abilities, all of his intellectual labor, all of his passion and love for the people, to really fighting against injustice and digging down to the roots of where it comes from and taking responsibility for envisioning and laying a scientific framework and basis for a world where humanity can be emancipated. And that's somebody that people need to get to know, and that's the content that people can going to be able to hear and need to hear. And this is a very big deal. So I'm very happy. I'm just thrilled to have been able to announce it last night and to share it with you and your listeners today.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And people, start making plans to get to Berkeley when this happens. All right. Right now. Sansara, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And we'll have to have you back real soon because I do want to pursue that Antifa thing too. Okay.
Yeah, great. We will do that.
All right. Thanks a lot, Sansara. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we have just been talking with Sansara Taylor, and she's a writer for RevCom.us, and she's also one of the initiators of RefuseFascism.org. And the pieces that she talked about, one piece she talked about will be linked on my Facebook page, both of them, I guess, actually, and the announcement about BA speaking, about Bob Avakian speaking, is also going to be posted on my Facebook page. And you can read Bob Avakian's account of the free speech movement in Berkeley on my Facebook page as well. We're going to take a quick break and be right back, so stay tuned.
We are the ones. We'll see you faint, tear down your state. Go get your guns. We came to fight. It's your disgrace. Smash up your place. That's just polite. That's just polite. Check it out.
All right, welcome back. That's Boots Riley with We Are the Ones. All right. And I think I picked that song especially for my next guest. You know, on July 20th in 2016, it was the wrap-up days of the Republican National Convention. They were getting all set. That was the day that they were going to choose Trump as the head fascist candidate that they had for the country and the world, quite frankly. And outside, it wasn't going so easy for them. The RNC 16 protesters who were arrested for burning an American flag on that day. And it was during a righteous political protest that occurred outside the Republican National Convention. And a number of people were arrested, and they were all facing charges. And many of them still are facing charges for basically violating all kinds of laws, burning the flag and putting people in danger. And yesterday, two of them actually found out that the first two that were going to be put on trial found out that the courts had dropped their case, had backed off of it. And it's a very significant victory for the people. And they're joining us now to talk. One of the speakers and Joey Johnson, who was also one of the people that burned a flag at the Republican National Convention at that time period. They're both here to talk with us today about this. Joey, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael. Great to be with you.
You too, man. And Bo, welcome to the show, man.
Hey, Michael. Can you hear me?
Absolutely, man. Yes, okay. Yes, I can. Okay. And I want people to know that actually Bo is one of the people who I was just talking about who was arrested for burning the flag outside the convention and was due to go on trial along with Nico. They were due to go on trial. Was it today you were supposed to go on trial or very soon? And we're greeted with the announcement that they weren't, in fact, going to be put on trial, that the charges were being dropped. Although I do have to say that people need to remember the charges against everyone else who was arrested that day actually still stand and they need to be fought. Let me ask you the first question. What was it? Give people a more, you know, sort of filled out picture of what was going on than I was doing. What was it, that happened that day? It was a huge effort meant to set the tone for a fascist future on the side of the system, what they were doing with Trump and the Republican Party and all this other stuff. What actually happened that day?
Yeah, absolutely, Michael. I mean, this is Joey speaking. First, to start out, you know, these conventions are not just standalone events. They're highly choreographed, you know, and this was a $50 million that the Homeland Security and the Secret Service spent to make Cleveland like a lockdown police state atmosphere for Trump's chauvinistic, racist, white supremacist message of make America great again. And the Revolution Club put out a call across the country, you know, for people to come there to protest against this, to take a stand and to stand with the people of the world. And that's what we did. And we gathered people from around the country to make the trek to Cleveland. And what we confronted was not only the police, but these reactionaries, these fascists that aligned with Alex Jones's InfoWars, these armed militia types, Westboro Baptist Church types. It was a whole lockdown atmosphere within Cleveland, a police state atmosphere that we were stepping into. And it's actually not good that the state and this whole, the security measures they took was pretty much successful in keeping away the hundreds and thousands of people that should have been there. I mean, if you remember, Trump ran out of Chicago in the spring, or he was prevented from doing a speaking engagement there because students poured out in their thousands to denounce and disrupt it. And that was a good thing. So there was a lot of preparations made for the RNC, for Trump to be able to belch out his chauvinistic message, you know, attacking immigrants, attacking Muslims, attacking women, you know, his whole build the wall, scapegoating of immigrants, his whole you know, if we got nuclear weapons, why can't we use them? It's for him to belch all that out. And so the Revolution Club felt we definitely need to be there to oppose all this and to make a strong internationalist stand that we're standing with the people of the world. And that's what we did. We went right up to the gates of the RNC, and we said America was never great, that it's always been the first at genocide, the first at invasion, the first at terrorizing people across the planet, the first at destruction of the global environment, the first at occupying people's countries and bombing them. So we're standing with the people of the world, and with that, we burned the American flag to make that internationalist statement. And that was sharply in juxtaposition to the American chauvinism that was being belched out of the convention with Trump, with Rudolph Giuliani, to make stop and frisk. He wanted to make that the law of the land, you know, even though it had been ruled unconstitutional in New York. So there's a lot that we had to expose and condemn outside the convention, right at the gates of it. And the most powerful way to do it was to burn the symbol of the empire, burn the symbol of oppression, the American flag.
This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking with notorious flag burner Joey Johnson and with Bo, a member of the Revolution Club. They are two of the RNC 16 protesters who were attacked and arrested by the police when an American flag was burnt outside of the Republican convention in Cleveland in 2016, following the nomination of the fascist Trump. Now, I read somewhere where actually you guys were, your assessment of this was that the attacks on Bo and Nico and the attack that happened on you as well, Joey, were actually things that were planned, that this was kind of a way that the system actually was not going to allow, that they weren't going to allow any kind of action like that, anything that would actually bring some truth into the thing, and that there was actually an assault that was that hit at 16 people, arrested 16 people, that Bo and Nico were arrested and charged with a number of crimes, a number of charges, and including felony charges, very serious felony charges that could have put them away for years. Tell us a little bit about that. What's your assessment about why this was hitting so hard?
Well, to begin with, so your audience knows, look, I was a defendant in 1989 in the U.S. Supreme Court flag burning case for burning the American flag at a protest against Ronald Reagan in 1984 at the Republican convention then. And I fought the case for 5 years all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in 1989, my conviction was overturned. And it was decided that burning the American flag in protest is a form of constitutionally protected political speech, right? So when we went to Cleveland in 2016, 32 years later, we announced 2 days ahead of time in a press release that I was going to be burning the American flag. So the fact that it was protected political speech was known to all. The police had that press release, the Secret Service had it, Homeland Security had it, and yet they organized a pre-planned attack against our protest to shut it down. It's like, to hell with it. Even what their own Supreme Court says, this was interfering with this whole ugly Make America Great chauvinist message of the convention, and they were going to attack it. And that's what they did. And Bo will talk now more about the charges and how the system hit that.
Go ahead, Bo.
Start with what the charges were. I mean, there were numerous felony charges put against Nico and me, and then there are several misdemeanor charges put against us. And then you have all these other misdemeanor charges that are put against the remains men. And then you have this whole, like, way they went about trying to go after Joey by, like, just changing the charges from time to time, trying to find something that could stick, but not just so they could charge him, but so they could send a message that they were going to come after you, and they're going to make sure that you realize that you weren't going to be able to get away with this. The whole way this was set up was a massive preemptive assault, and it wasn't just to get us off the streets, but it was to keep us off the street. Because they didn't want our message out there, but they also wanted their message getting out there, that they weren't going to tolerate Trump not being able to have his platform, to, as Joey put it, belch out this toxic message of Make America Great Again.
Yeah, exactly. Good ending there. But, Bo, I want to ask you one other thing. People don't know this, but you actually were, you're a vet, and you're somebody who actually went into the war after, you went into the U.S. military after 9/11. And you spent quite some time in there and went to war two times on that. What is it that made you, in particular, feel so compelled now to stand up against these Nazis and everything they stand for and to actually burn one of their iconic, their sacred icons?
Well, I mean, I guess, yeah, if I can give you a little bit of background, I mean, yeah, I bought the lies for a long time. I bought the lies that, you know, America's military spreads democracy around the world. But afterwards, I never could get this ugly taste out of my mouth. Of it just didn't seem right. And as I kept on analyzing it more and more, I started to see that they weren't spreading democracy. They're spreading destruction. And then, like, as I got involved with RCP, you know, and I got into Bob Avakian's teachings, I actually got into the understanding of what America spreads around the world isn't democracy, but it's capitalist imperialism. And so you can see the way the military operates around the world is spread that kind of message. You know, that's why they spread all this death and destruction, because that's in line with how they spread their capitalist imperialism, by oppressing other nations. It is nothing in Manafort's story about the way that they, conduct themselves. There's nothing in Manafort's story about the way I conducted myself or any of the units I conducted myself with while I served in Iraq and these wars of empire. And by burning this flag, this rag that stands for America, it was part of a process of realizing that American lives aren't more important than other people's lives. It was how I broke with all that nasty American chauvinism that's being shoved down people's throats right now. You know, it was a necessary step that I actually needed to take. I don't know actually if I actually even realized it at the time, but now when I look back, it's like this huge burden's been taken off my shoulders, where I can actually see that I stand with the people of the world and I'm not going to be coerced into this forced patriotism that Donald Trump's trying to push on people.
Mm-hmm. Joey, let's go back to you for a minute. This forcing them to drop the charges, you already sort of alluded to this, but it was a really important victory for people. It's really important that, and I think, you know, to drop the charges against Bo and Nico, who also was played a very significant role in this and has, you know, someone who came from a section of society that basically is getting hit all the time around this, that people stood up and did this, and they were put on trial. And there's something really important here about forcing the rulers to drop the charges, that this was a victory, a real victory, not just sort of one that you can go out and celebrate. I mean, they were really trying to make a point with the arrests of all of the, was it 16 people that were arrested and charged? But in particular, going after Bo and Nico first, and the way that they were going after them and the charges that they faced, and then all of a sudden, they're forced to back down. The system is forced to back down. Let's talk about the significance of this, because this was a real victory, and people need to understand that.
Absolutely. You know, these brothers were facing very serious charges. Nico faced 4 years in prison. Bo faced 7 or more. You know, this was a real threat against them and against everyone who wants to stand up and everyone who's sickened by the chauvinism of the Trump regime, the ugliness of it, that this is, as we've been saying, being belched out to the people of the world and people who feel inspired and want to stand up against it. So the stakes were very high, and we had to, I think that the way that the case was fought from the beginning, we had a right to do what we did, and it was the right time to do it. It was exactly the message that needed to be sent to the people of the world, that needed to be gotten out in the media across the planet. So it was a beautiful thing that we did it. The fact that they were forced to back off was because we fought this case. The Revolution Club was determined. All of the defendants were determined. The more than 30 lawyers that came forward over the course of the summer and were voluntarily putting forward their legal services with the National Lawyers Guild, we were all firm that we were going to fight this case. And we came back to Cleveland ready to go to court and ready to do battle. The fact that they backed off, I think, was because of the fight that had been raised against them, and that they knew that this was actually, we had so much truth on our side. You know, we could go on about it for hours. We had shown completely that this was a premeditated police attack on something we had a right to do because of the ruling in my case, was never a gift from America. It was something that was hard fought for against government political repression, against what I call forced patriotism. And so, you know, that's how we've prevailed to the point that we have. And there's more that remains to be done.
Mm-hmm. Now, we're running out of time, but I wanted to ask you, are there more trials coming up?
Yeah, there's two more trials. There's 12 more defendants that are still facing charges. We've yet to hear from the court about when the trial date will be for those cases or what will be the status of those charges in the aftermath of this really important ruling of the charges being dismissed against Bo and Nico. They were dismissed with what's called with prejudice, which means they cannot be refiled. This is a big, big victory for the RNC 16 as a whole. But now we want the charges dropped against the other 12 defendants.
Mm-hmm. All right. Is there anything more that either you or Bo would like to add before we sign off?
Well, we need people to call in to Kimberly Barnett Mills. Phone number is 216-664-4850, and that's the prosecutor that's charged with the other 12 remaining defendants. So people need to call and demand those charges get dropped right now.
All right, and the phone number will be put on my Facebook page. What was her name? Give her a name. You went out at when you said that. What was her name?
Kimberly Barnett Mills. And then Joey's got one more thing.
All right, Joey, go ahead.
I just say, you know, our intentions in the felony trials, and we're going to do it in the misdemeanor cases, is to put the police, their actions, their premeditated plans on trial.
Good. We'll follow along with that. Keep in touch with us, all right?
Yeah, and tell your listeners to keep going to revcom.us for more updates.
All right, great. Thanks a lot, Joey. Thanks a lot, Bo. And give my best to Nico and everybody else, all right?
Will do.
All right, take care now.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Joey Johnson and Bo. And we've been talking about the attacks on people for standing up against the fascist regime during the Fascist Republican National Convention, all right? We're going to take a quick break right now and be right back to talk about a new play. So stay tuned. Welcome back. It's Dwight Tribble, right? And just an incredible piece. Right, last Saturday, I was lucky enough to go to, I guess it was the opening night of a play that was just incredible. It was really, really incredible. And it was something that was really needed, that's really needed in these times. Even though it's based on something that happened in history, it was something that's really living today. Now, regular listeners know that I sometimes include segments on plays that you may not be able to see in your area when the questions they address are important in a larger sense. That's why I want you to be able to hear the interview I did with two of the actors from the play La Raison Blindada, or Armored Reason. It's a two-person play written and directed by Aristides Vargas. The play is based on real events in the prisons of Argentina during the so-called Dirty War, which began in 1974 under a fascist military government, which was supported by the U.S. I thought that what it said about courageously asserting your humanity in the face of ruthless authoritarianism resonates with the political situation that we and all of humanity are facing with a fascist white supremacist in the White House. And I'm really pleased to be welcoming to the show the two actors from that play, Jesus, and you'll have to correct me if I don't get it, Jesus Castaños Chima?
Exactly.
Chima, okay. And Tony Duran. You were easy, Tony.
See?
And of course, it's I do have to learn Spanish, so I was trying very hard on that. Well, let's do it this way. Chima, yes. Tell my listeners about the play. What's it about?
Oh, actually, this play is about the experiences that political prisoners went through during the dictatorship in Argentina in the 70s. And actually, the story is about this prisoners being in jail and being isolated for a week, and they were only allowed to gather, you know, to be together and talk for an hour on Sundays. And what they did, instead of, you know, talking, they decided to do theater, you know, to play around, you know, the scenes with about El Quijote and Sancho Panza.
Well, I was just going to ask about what the play is based on, but before we get to that, because the play is actually based on some famous works, right?
Yes.
Okay. So why don't we talk about what they're based on, and then I'll ask you this next question after that.
No, actually, the play was based on the story of Chicho Vargas, which is brother of Aristides Vargas, the playwright. Mm-hmm. And also, because he was Aristides, he was asked to write something about El Quijote. And so what he did, he mixed, you know, like his brother's story with El Quijote and the truth story about Sancho Panza by Kafka.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this play, when you talk about what happened in Argentina, is actually being a big part of this in a certain sense. This, in Argentina, for people to understand, beginning in 1974 and continuing for the next 10 years, the military rulers carried out what they call, what humanity calls a dirty war. 30,000 people were murdered by these death squads, and or they were rounded up or tortured and disappeared. Their bodies often thrown into the ocean from military transports during that period. And actually, sure enough, Henry Kissinger, the Secretary of State at that time for the U.S. and despicable war criminal, congratulated the military for doing an outstanding job in wiping out terrorist forces. Yeah. Now, you guys come and what you show in this play, and I think it's really important because and you can't be modest around this, right? Because what you show in this play, it's also the other thing that happened to the prisoners that you were talking about is that you were tortured. The prisoners were tortured. They were beaten. They were, you know, I mean, they were 24/7 for the entire time of that week. And on 1 hour, right, it was 1 hour on a Sunday afternoon, they had the ability, they were allowed to sit down and talk with other prisoners and talk to each other. And but if you got up and you moved your hands off the table, you would be shot.
Yes.
And that's the kind of, so when you're talking about the kind of life that is enforced, not only are you just savagely attacking the prisoners mentally and physically, but then in that 1 hour where you have to talk and create some space in terms of yourself, you know, it's sort of, if you violated this, even took your hands off the table, you could be shot and killed.
Yeah, actually, they decided to do this because they wanted to keep sane, you know, because what they did, they built this, you know, the way they say in the play, that they built this tunnel to another reality where they can be themselves, where they can laugh and have fun and say whatever they think. And that was the only way for them. Otherwise, you know, they go insane, crazy. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but besides that, even though this place is based on the Argentinian dictatorship, if you really see the play, you know, the playwright doesn't give us any specifics about this this dictatorship, because I think his purpose is to, he wants everybody to relate to the play. You know, it's something universal that is happening, and it has happened everywhere in the world, you know, with all this dictatorship that we have over the years. And so whoever has any knowledge about dictatorship or whoever has been in one of them, you know, they can easily relate to what we are saying.
Or anybody who is, including the dictatorship that produces the kinds of prisons that the U.S. has all around the world, where people are kept in solitary for a dozen years. You know, this is, and that's the land of the free, right?
Yes,
telling
exactly.
This, you know, which was also the land of the free that backed up all the torture and suffering of people in South America. Did you have anything to add to this, Tony? Did you want to add anything, or?
¿Quieres agregar algo?
Bueno, pues hacer un llamado a toda la comunidad que nos apoyen, ¿no? Esta obra que está tocando este tema, ¿no? Tan fuerte que, bueno, que pasó en Argentina, pero que se está presentando aquí, ¿no? Como los sistemas autoritarios, ¿no? Nos imponen leyes y pues uno tiene que verse limitado con todas esas cosas, ¿no?
What he's saying is that he wants to invite the audience to come and see this play, talking about, you know, the times that we are living now, about, you know, oppression and you know, when we are when we have no freedom to, you know, to do things that we normally do.
Mm-hmm. This is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm talking today with Tony Duran and Jesus Castanos Chima, the two actors in the play La Razón Blindada, or Armored Reason. And I wanted to add to Chima's translation of Tony's remarks. He emphasized that they were dramatizing events that took place in Argentina, but it's about what happens in all authoritarian systems which have these systems of rule. Well, tell me this, because one of the things that really, you know, it would be just an amazing experience enough if it was just telling the story of what happened to the prisoners there at the time, and the terror that it spread everywhere in the country and in the world, wherever this happens, you know, it's partly to make the prisoners pay a price, but it's also a price that they want to make the population pay by scaring them and making them, you know, think that, okay, we can't do anything, we're powerless. And actually, there was something that was very beautiful about this play, which was that you guys were able to. And what happened, where you every Sunday came together for that 1 hour, and I have to tell you, folks, it's you're kind of sitting on the edge of your seat because they're getting up, and all the time you're just like, okay, they're getting up. You know that they're not allowed to get up. You know that they're not allowed to take their hands off the table, but the defiance that was there. But then the beauty of the of what people did to sort of maintain their humanity, to assert their humanity, not maintain it, to assert their humanity in the face of all this by the kinds of things that you brought together. You know, you brought little plays together that you would work out for each other. You perform for each other. You'd both take part of different pieces. And that was really important in terms of the importance of art in society, you know, in terms of importance of basically being able to do that. And let's talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, what I was told by Aristides was that, you know, the real story was that they were four guys. You know, they were not actors. They were, you know, political activists and, you know, writers and artists and but not actors. And but they decided to, you know, to play this game. And so every Sunday, there were four friends. So two friends play, you know, that they were doing the actors and the other two were the audience. So, and they have different codes to, you know, because they cannot be seen like applauding, you know, like the applause. It was like, you know, like with your fingers, just, you know, like mimicking like you were applauding, but, you know. And the following Sunday, they did the opposite. The other two, they just changed roles. You know, the other two were the actors and the other two the audience. And of course, they were doing this. There is a sense of, you know, the time was against them because they need to perform very quick. So if you notice in the play, this is, you know, it's very dynamic because you need to move fast because the guards can come and if they see that you're doing something that you're not supposed to, they will, you know, do something to you. So that's... And that's, you know, that's, and also if you, the play is very unique because we are always, you know, what, as you were saying, that we are always sitting in these two chairs. And so I remember when we did the play, I thought that when we started, you know, rehearsing, I thought that it was going to be very simple and easy for us because we were sitting all the time and it was okay, I'm going to be relaxing. But it's really, you know, it requires a lot of training because, you know, you're using your stomach in order to move, you know, with your legs and, so that's one of the challenges, and also to approach the way we approach these characters, you know, because for all these experience that they went through, it was not easy for us to understand that the way these guys think and how they decided instead of talking about other things, they decided to play. So it was so terrible. This situation, this oppressing situation, that they didn't want to talk about those things. They said, "Let's have fun. Let's keep sane, because otherwise we're gonna go crazy."
Well, there's a little bit too. I think, and actually a lot I felt anyway, is this in the defiance that you guys, your characters, were actually bringing forward. The defiance against the regime was very inspiring, and I think for people who, even if people find out about it later, I don't know how much people knew about it during the time, but that whole, you know, as someone said to me, the transcendent power of imagination in humanity, you know, and the idea that you can rise above this, and not by making peace with your torturers, but by asserting your humanity in that 1 hour you had each week, you know, which is very, very inspiring, I think.
Yeah, and I think, you know, nowadays, because we did this play 7 years ago, and I think it's, you know, when we thought about it, it's the story is even more relevant today than it was 7 years ago, because that's what's happening now. It's, you know, people, you know, the same way these guys created this other world to become themselves and, you know, like to be free and do, say and think whatever they want. This is the same thing we are doing now somehow. You know, we are creating our own bubbles, you know, like just waiting for these 4 years to go by and hoping that it's not going to be more than that.
But we need to do, people need to do more than create the bubbles.
Exactly. So, and that's a big mistake because, you know, we're supposed to be more involved in this and see how we can help to, you know, bring everybody together again.
And to stand up against this. And in a way, that's the point about the transcendent power of imagination, because they were not able to silence, you know, the characters that you played in this play. They were not able to silence them, you know, even, you know, to the bitter end, they weren't able to silence them. And that was both That was inspiring. Just let's leave it at that. And I think it inspires people to look at things in a different way.
Yeah, no, thank you. And thank you very much for coming and for coming and see it.
And I'm going to tell people this because we got to get to this, but we don't want to run out of time and not have this. The play, once again, the play is La Razón Blindada, Armored Reason. It'll have you thinking and talking with your friends for weeks, all right? I'm telling you, it's a very powerful play. All right, folks, thanks a lot for joining us today.
No, thank you, Michael. Thank you for inviting us.
All right, we're going to go out now. I want to say, thanks to all of my guests today. I want to thank all of my listeners today. I want to thank my board op, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and everybody else who contributed to this show. And if you want to write to me or give me any of your thoughts, you can by writing to mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. We're going out now with Thievery Corporation and Sound the Alarm, because damn, we need to sound an alarm today.